It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are going through their times of reckoning. We talked yesterday, for example, about Joe Biden's long support for the Hyde Amendment, which bans federal Medicaid funding for abortions for women with low incomes, as what he used to call a middle ground on the abortion rights issue. One question for Biden now is, can he be the champion for women's rights with that history as the party's nominee for president in 2020 in the context of a disappearing middle ground? And Governor Cuomo yesterday was exasperated by my asking about his endorsement of the more establishment candidate, as I put it, in the Queens DA race over the one backed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and my asking about it in establishment versus progressive wing terms.
You know, establishment, progressive, this is all terms of the current political frenzy.
Governor Cuomo on yesterday's show. There are so many more examples we could cite. The Democrats are going through a reckoning. Well, here's one way to understand the reckoning the Republicans are going through right now. Did you see the piece today by New York Times conservative columnist Ross Douthat? It's a big think article that focuses on a conservative manifesto published recently in the journal First Things called Against the Dead Consensus. Now, the dead consensus, as they see it, is sort of William Buckley, Ronald Reagan's coalition, that coalition that said limited government, free markets, a hawkish foreign policy, and cultural conservatism could exist under one tent. The concern of the new populists is that the free market and war hawk contingents dominated the coalition while marriage rates and birth rates plummeted, LGBT rights flourished more than religious liberty, and Roe versus Wade was never really overturned. So now comes Trump-era populism. Never mind how Trump himself has lived his life. The Mike Pence social conservatives have more power in his coalition than they did in, say, Ronald Reagan's, and the working class gets to push back on the globalist businesses that were allowed to hollow out middle-class economics, and with it, the traditional family. So the so-called dead consensus is replaced by a new living one. Borders more closed, both to capital leaving and immigrants coming, and more insistent than ever on the power of the state to curb abortion and other affronts to conservative religious sensibilities. All of that from Ross Douthat, his shot today at helping New York Times readers who are baffled by the support for Trump understand some of what's happening, at least through that lens of the so-called dead conservative consensus. My first guest today has a lot to say in his own right about conservative sensibilities. He is the legendary conservative columnist George Will, seen in the Washington Post since 1974 and elsewhere as well. It's telling that he was a Fox News contributor from 2013 to 2017 and then became an MSNBC contributor. And George Will has a brand new 600-page take on conservative sensibilities that does not even mention the name Donald Trump. The book is called The Conservative Sensibility. George, we always appreciate when you come on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
I'm glad to be with you.
Can I ask you to react first? I don't know how much of that intro you heard, but to the idea, or if you saw Ross Douthat's column today, but this idea of the dead consensus as an explanation for the rise of Trump. Do you identify with a side of that as I was laying it out?
I did hear it, and I do identify with a side of it. I believe that free markets, limited government, justified by and explained by the natural rights theory of the founders. This is the conservatism that the progressive movement set out with remarkable forthrightness and remarkable success to overthrow in the 20th century. And what I've tried to do in my book is explain the founders' vision, the progressive revision, and the superiority of the first. At this point, the Republican Party is simply not a vessel of ideas anymore. Well, you know, one of the great books of post-war conservatism as it began its intellectual revival was titled Ideas Have Consequences. Well, the absence of ideas also has consequences, and one of them is the kind of president we now have. And the kind of president we now have is he's occupying a ridiculously inflated presidential role in our politics, partly because the progressives, impatient with the separation of powers, eager for a more nimble, to use one of Woodrow Wilson's adjectives, a more nimble government, have given us a rampant executive that I think, well, progressives celebrated the growth of the presidency. Now that it's occupied by someone they don't much care for, perhaps they'll have second thoughts about presidential power.
What's the root of that? Is it FDR?
Oh, no, it's Woodrow Wilson, really. And it was a sort of prototype in Teddy Roosevelt, who had a stewardship theory of the presidency, which was that a president has the power to do whatever he wants as long as it's not explicitly forbidden, which means virtually no limits on the presidency. But it was Woodrow Wilson who was the first president to criticize the American founding, which he did not do peripherally. He did a root and branch. He said the fundamental Madisonian architecture of limited government, sustained by a separation of powers, was all very well once upon a time when we were a country in which 80% of the American people lived within 20 miles of Atlantic tidewater. But now, said Wilson, we're a giant continental nation united by steel rails and copper wires, and we need to transcend Congress and transcend the separation of powers, pour executive power into the president and into agencies that would be created by him, and what we now call the administrative state. So it's Woodrow Wilson is really the father of our current condition.
So you see a straight line from Woodrow Wilson, federal government progressivism, to Donald Trump telling Hope Hicks and Don McGahn to defy congressional subpoenas?
Yes, and well, just look at if you want to know what the reverse of conservatism is, look at protectionism. This is the government telling us what we can buy, in what quantities, and at what prices. And the president is doing this, essentially raising American taxes unilaterally, because Congress, under both parties, has given power to presidents of both parties that they have no right in Congress to delegate. So the president is able to simply declare an emergency and repurpose money from the from one spending to another to build a wall. He can declare another emergency and say that national security is threatened by imports of Audis and Volkswagens and impose tariffs. He can say, I'm going to send money, weapons to Saudi Arabia and its allies in the Yemen war, in spite of Congress saying they have to have a say in this, because Congress wrote the law with a huge loophole in it that said, in fact, if the president declares an emergency, he can act on his own. This is executive power rampant, and it's dangerous.
Right, and the Republicans in the Senate seem to actually be pushing back on this idea that the president can declare an immigration emergency at the border or an asylum emergency at the border and use it to impose economic policy tariffs on Mexico. But here's a clip of the president, this is in the last day or two, with something that he said that's such a huge thing, and he mentions it as almost a side effect of what the tariffs on imports from Mexico might produce.
We're going to put tariffs on. And every month those tariffs go from 5% to 10% to 15% to 20% and then to 25%. And what will happen then is all of those companies that have left our country and gone to Mexico are going to be coming back to us. And that's okay. That's okay.
Now, what really amazed me about that cut was that he was only saying that in the context of trying to get Mexico to close the border to the migrants, when he's articulating there a huge fundamental idea. You say they're bereft of ideas. I know it's an old idea, but it's an idea that Trump ran on and that a lot of his voters, I think is real, that if you do impose more tariffs on imports, not just from Mexico, some of the hollowing out of the American working class, middle class that has taken place over the last several decades might get reversed. What's your thought?
Well, I invite the president to go back to southwestern Pennsylvania, where he did well in 2016, to say Donora, Pennsylvania, or Monongahela, and other towns that have been truly casualties of globalization, and they lost their steel jobs. 4 years later, the steel jobs are still not going to be there. Now, the president can say we're going to stop migrants crossing the border from south to north and cause American companies to cross the border from south to north instead. I ask you this. The president plans to run against what he calls socialism. Well, socialism, socialism is the government allocating capital, the government planning, superseding the market, in giving incentives for the allocation of wealth and opportunity. That's all he's doing. This is an enormous economic plan he's undertaking. When did conservatism become identified with economic planning? That's what I'd like to know.
Right. But one of the knocks against free market conservatism that comes from both the progressive wing and the right-wing populists is that in theory, it sounds like freedom, but in practice, it's been a formula for concentration of wealth, too much power in the hands of global corporations to produce things for $2 a day in China or wherever, instead of, you know, at decent wages in the United States. And that freedom has not actually benefited the American middle class.
Well, the American middle class has been an enormous beneficiary, not just for the last post-war period, but since the Industrial Revolution got going in Britain and in Holland in the late 19th century, late 18th century, rather. The fact is, there's never been a producer of wealth comparable to the market system that the United States and other nations similarly organized have had. Clearly, there are disruptions. Clearly, public policy should be designed to try and minimize the disruptions. But the idea that the United States can say globalization is too stressful, economic dynamism is too uncertain, the frictions are too painful, therefore, we're going to erect walls and seal ourselves off from this. The American people should be told they've already made choices that determine the choices they have to make about economic life. The choices they have been made in making enormous promises to themselves through entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and the rest, all of which depend on rapid economic growth to throw off the revenues to pay the bills for the promises. So it's a little bit too late to pull up the drawbridge and say, well, come to think about it, free markets and globalization are simply too stressful. You're going to give up on that. You're going to have to give up on economic dynamism. You're going to have to give up on the entitlement state.
My guest is George Will. His new book is called The Conservative Sensibility, and we can take phone calls for George Will. Anything you've always wanted to have George Will over to dinner to ask him, but he was never there. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. And because this work is such a big 600-page book, so kind of philosophically foundational, or so one review call it his capstone book out of, I think, 15 previous ones, some of which he's been on the show for. But so therefore, you can ask him basically about anything from his body of work and the ideas that we're talking about here. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In the conservative sensibility, according to you, George, are the free marketeers of Wall Street globalism natural allies with the Mike Pence religious conservatives?
Not really. And indeed, many of the free marketeers on Wall Street are not friends of free markets. The problem is that the national pastime, which used to be baseball, is now rent-seeking. That is, bending private factions, bending public power to private advantage, either by conferring advantages on themselves or disadvantages on others. Protectionism is the classic example. The simple truth is that Elizabeth Warren has a firm grip on half of a point. Elizabeth Warren says, rightly, that the government has become the plaything of these factions. The saying in Washington that if you set out a picnic, you expect to draw ants. And the biggest picnic in the world is the federal budget. There is a reason why 5 of the 10 most affluent counties in the United States by per capita income are in the Washington area. We have no natural resources down there. We don't make anything except regulations and problems and laws. But we prosper in good times and even more in bad times because the government is sluicing trillions of dollars through itself and distributing it to the country. Now, Elizabeth Warren says the answer to this is make the government bigger. How about entertaining the possibility that the government should be less active in the allocation of wealth and opportunity, that market forces should be allowed to do this, radically reduce the rent seeking, and restore economic growth? That, it seems to me, is a better agenda.
But you're back on the economics. My question about the social conservatives is, again, based on that article in First Things that I referenced at the top, the social conservatives feel disserved by these, 30, 40 years of the old conservative consensus where the businesses looking for tax cuts and trade liberalization and things like that got their way. There was a lot of lip service paid to social conservative, what they see as pro-family policies, abortion restrictions, things like that. But until the rise of the new populism, they never really paid it back. Did they, or how do you see the that particular break from the old conservative consensus?
Well, the old conservative consensus was called fusionism. That is, that it was going to be the fusion of the social conservatives and the limited government free market conservatives. That's what Frank Meyer and Bill Buckley and others did with National Review. I think what is happening is the social conservatives have awakened to the fact that they've lost comprehensively. Think about this. In 2004, one of the ways George Bush got reelected was putting on state ballots, Ohio springs to mind, various initiatives and referenda against same-sex marriage in order to bring out to the ballot box, and this worked, by the way, this is just 15 years ago, people opposed to same-sex marriage. The Supreme Court rules, and the country says, fine, the Supreme Court has ruled. It's one of the few remaining institutions with its prestige intact. So at this point, I think social conservatives are looking around and saying, where is our victory? Mm-hmm. If they're waiting for the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade, they have another 40 years to wait, because I do not believe it'll happen.
That's why they're now going state by state. But the word abortion does not appear in the index to your book. The first alphabetical entry, as you probably know, is Dean Acheson. And I didn't read the whole book. Is the issue of abortion nowhere in the conservative sensibility that you describe?
It is not. I mean, the issue of abortion is an interesting case of constitutional construction, but abortion is now one of America's more common surgical procedures. It's not going away. I do think that abortion rights advocates have become kind of like the NRA in a mirror way. The NRA resists every conceivable restraint on gun ownership because they think it's the thin end of the wedge of total abolition. The abortion rights people have done the same thing. The abortion rights people who won't hear about restricting third trimester abortions, they won't consider the possibility that France and Italy and Britain and Scandinavia, all of which have more restrictive abortion policies, are models that we might want to emulate. They simply won't conceive of the fact that at any point prior to birth, the preborn child has some kind of moral significance. So the extremists have taken over both sides of this.
Let's take a phone call. Aviva in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with George Will. Hi, Aviva.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I always admire what you do, and I've been interested in George Will's approach, although I vastly disagree with it. At least it's intelligent. My question is, what always seems to be left out of the conservative argument is what to do about the disadvantaged. It seems that the conservative argument has been that trickle-down theory will work, but research has shown that that's not true. With less government, what we have is more disadvantaged people. And so how do you approach the question of empathy for anybody who is not well off?
That's a fair question, but I would suggest the following, and this is a sobering and deeply depressing and alarming fact. The principal driver of inequality in the United States today is family disintegration. 1965, young social scientist in the Labor Department of Lyndon Johnson, a man who became my very closest friend, Pat Moynihan, later senator from New York, published a report in which he said there's a crisis in African-American society because 23.7% of African-American children are born out of wedlock. Today, the figure is 72%. 40% of all American first births, regardless of race, color, creed, national origin, are out of wedlock. A majority of mothers under 30 are not living with the fathers of their children. Now, that is a driver of inequality, the intergenerational transmission of poverty. We don't know what caused it. We don't know how to solve it. But until we find a way to slow this and reverse it, the disadvantages are going to remain so.
But this is an area where, and Aviva, thank you for raising this, where progressives, I think, would disagree extremely with your worldview. They'd say, even if you account for out-of-wedlock birth, you can predict a person's economic station in life in adulthood with pretty good accuracy on balance if you know the zip code they were born in or even the country they were born into. In other words, the natural abilities that you refer to in your book and the individualism that you see as such a high value actually are weak predictors of success, the progressives would say, because they ignore the structural inequalities that persist even in this country from generation to generation. Even when you compare a black person who grew up with only one parent and a white person who grew up with only one parent, that's the progressive project, as our caller articulates it, fighting structural inequality. So why do you think that given recent history, that conservatism doesn't ignore that too much?
Well, you're quite right. Far too much about an individual's prospect is determined by what we know about his family, particularly as society becomes more and more cognitively stratified, as society rewards those with the ability to manipulate ideas and information rather than muscle power that powered the country through its first two centuries. But it's very important to understand how conservatives have to rethink, and I have an entire long chapter in the book on this, equality of opportunity. Conservatives have always said, a little too facilely, we're against equality of condition and equality of outcome. We're for equality of opportunity. Well, it turns out equality of opportunity is an awful lot murkier and more problematic than we realize.
It takes intervention, doesn't it?
Sure. Look, 200 years ago, the great source of wealth in America was land, and we had so much of it, we were essentially giving it away. A century ago, the great source of wealth was heavy fixed capital. Think of Andrew Carnegie's steel mills or Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad. Today, the great source of wealth is education, what we call human capital. The market is saying at the top of its lungs, stay in school, but there are limits to how much even universal free public education can do to equalize the ability of individuals to add value to the economy. So if we're going to attack this, it's going to be an entirely new challenge for conservatives and progressives alike to understand the sheer viscosity of society as it tries to equalize opportunity.
Carl on Staten Island, you're on WNYC with George Will. Hi, Carl.
Good morning, Mr. Will. First of all, I'd like to say that I have always admired you, even if I disagreed with you on most issues. My comment is this. In, I believe it was 1998, before he died, Barry Goldwater, who was one of my heroes growing up, stated that the Republican Party was in big trouble because it was being taken over by the evangelical wing of the party. And what he said seems to have been borne out by what has happened over the last few years. Did he actually make that statement? Because I never heard him say it. And what is your thought on that subject?
You've raised one of my favorite topics. I cast my first presidential vote in 1964 for Barry Goldwater. The book, The Conservative Sensibility, is dedicated to the memory of Barry Goldwater, who Richard Rovere, a wonderful political columnist for The New Yorker, described as the cheerful malcontent. I like to think that applies to me, too. I think Goldwater did say what you quote him as saying, partly because he had a gay grandson and he was became sensitized to the challenges of inclusion facing that community. But Goldwater was from the wide open spaces of Arizona, from the American West, where conservatism basically meant leave me alone. He was from a place with very little past to conserve. I mean, my goodness. There are now 4 million people in the Valley of the Sun, and there were about 100,000 when Barry Goldwater grew up in the Phoenix area. I think Goldwater is right. It's interesting. The book begins with my dedication to Goldwater. The next to last chapter in my book is called Conservatism Without Theism. And it tries to make the argument that there is no intrinsic, no logical connection between conservatism and theism, religion of any sort, that the conservative argument stands on its own without any help from religious credentials.
Goldwater in 64 was against the Civil Rights Act, wasn't he? That's one of the reasons he got so discredited.
He was, and it was a huge mistake. I don't think anyone believes that Barry Goldwater was a racist. He had a constitutional problem with the public accommodation sections and other things. He was just quite wrong, and he came to understand that. This before he was even a senator. He helped integrate the Arizona Air National Guard. The Goldwater department stores took the lead in Arizona in integrating its workforce. So no one ever, I think, accused Goldwater of racism. Bad judgment on this, certainly.
I mentioned in the intro that you were a Fox News contributor from 2013 until the beginning of Trump's term in office in 2017. Then you became an MSNBC contributor. I'm curious what you think will happen after Trump, kind of in that context. Let's say a Democrat is elected president next year, but the Republicans keep the Senate. Do we go back to the Obama era stalemate on everything, and do you go back to Fox News?
To the latter, no. To the former question, probably would have stalemate. However, I do think Biden as an ex-senator, Biden as an affable man, Biden as someone who's not angry, would, I think, be able to begin to melt the freeze that has come over Washington. But that's one of the reasons why some people of a disposition at least similar to mine are going to say, look, if it looks as though the Republicans are going to hold the Senate, then a lot of these Democratic candidates are more or less acceptable because legislatively not much as radical can happen. Appointments to the regulatory agencies can make an enormous difference, so it wouldn't be as though a progressive president would be without consequence. He'd be very consequential, or she would be very consequential. But a lot of Republicans might vote tactically for a Democrat in the sure and certain hope that the Senate would remain in Republican hands.
You laughed when I asked if you would then go back to Fox News. Is there anything you're willing to say about how you see Fox News's role in the country now compared to, say, when you did work for them?
Well, there's Fox News and there's Fox News. The Brett Baiers and the Chris Wallaces and others are just very able, distinguished journalists. Fox News as an enterprise, it seems to me, is taken us in a way back to the future. You know, when our party system emerged in the 1790s, many of the most important newspapers in the country were party newspapers. Indeed, Jefferson, for example, as Secretary of State, arranged printing contracts to support friendly newspapers. So we've, in a way, we're gone back to now partisan, party-supporting journalistic entities. MSNBC and Fox are both similar in this regard. They have different bases, different audiences. But as I say, this is not without precedent in American history.
So one more potential future before we run out of time. How different do you think the world would be if Trump is impeached and removed and Mike Pence becomes president? Sometimes the Democrats forget that it wouldn't be Hillary Clinton. Mike Pence would become president. And then let's say he's also elected next year. Then what?
Well, Mike Pence is, some people might say, is Trump's insurance policy against impeachment, just as some people said Spiro Agnew was Nixon's policy, insurance against impeachment. Of course, he had to resign before he could fulfill that, being that insurance policy. Look, Donald Trump, let me say this slowly and clearly to all your progressive listeners, Donald Trump is not going to be removed from office other than by votes in 2020. Even if they, a lot of Americans don't seem to realize that impeachment is just means indictment and they send it to the Senate for trial. There is no way, it is inconceivable, that a Republican Senate is going to produce enough votes to remove the president. Get over it.
But from your own sensibilities, and then we're out of time, based on the Mueller report and maybe things in addition to the Mueller report that you think about Donald Trump, how much do you think he deserves to be removed from office based on standards of behavior that the framers had in mind?
Well, that's it's what I've called, quite seriously and seriously, there is such a thing as an aesthetic impeachment. I believe that Donald Trump is doing more damage to America, lasting damage, because you can't unring a bell, by what he has now made normal in public discourse, the name-calling, the lying, and all the rest. He's doing more lasting damage than Nixon did with his surreptitious burglary and other crimes, which were surreptitious for a reason, because once you spotted them, you could punish them and move on. It's going to be much harder for the country to move on. But how do you impeach a man for being what we knew he was already when he was elected? How do you impeach a man for keeping the campaign promise, which was to govern in a loutish manner that he campaigned for the office on? Very difficult to impeach a man for promise keeping, even if the promises are, in many ways, contemptible.
George Will's new book is The Conservative Sensibility. We always appreciate when you come on the show. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.